Tibetan Sage by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 2. We looked about us, and we seemed to be in a sort of corridor, lined on both sides with lockers or closets or something similar. Anyway, I pulled experimentally on a handle, and a big drawer slid out as smoothly as if it had just been made. Inside, there were all manner of strange devices. The Lama Mingyar Dondup was peering over my shoulder. He picked up one of the pieces and said, "Ah, this will be spare parts. I have no doubt that these lockers contain spare parts enough to make this thing work again." We pushed the drawer shut and moved on. The light moved ahead of us and dimmed as we passed, and soon we came to a large room. As we entered, it became brilliantly illuminated, and we both gasped. This was obviously the control room of the thing, but what made us gasp was the fact that there were men about. One was sitting in what I imagined to be the control chair, and he was peering at a meter on a board in front of him. There were quite a number of meters, and I surmised that he was just getting ready to take off. "But how can these be millions of years old? These men look alive, but soundly asleep." There was another man sitting at a table, and he had some large charts in front of him. He had his head held between his hands, and his elbows rested on the table. We spoke in whispers. It was awesome, and our science was nothing but mumbo-jumbo compared to this. The Lama Mingyar Dondup caught hold of one of these figures by the shoulder and said, "I think these men are in some form of suspended animation. I think they could be brought back to life, but I do not know how to do it. I do not know what would happen if I did know how to do it. As you know, Lobsang, there are other caves in this mountain range, and we visited one with strange implements in it, like ladders, which, apparently, worked mechanically. But this beats anything I have seen so far, and as one of the senior lamas who is responsible for maintaining these intact, I can tell you that this one is the most wonderful of all, and wonder if there are any other knobs that we should press to open other rooms. But let us have a good look in this one first. We have about a week, because I think it will take at least that long before I am fit to climb down the mountainside." We went around looking at other figures, seven of them in all, and they all gave the impression that they were ready to take off when something frightful occurred. It looked as if there had been an earthquake which toppled heavy rocks on what was probably a sliding roof. The Lama stopped and approached another man who had a notebook in front of him. Obviously he had been writing the record of what was happening, but we could not read the writing. We had no basis for assuming that these things were letters, ideographs, or even just technical symbols. The Lama said, In all our searches, we have not found anything which would enable us to translate. Wait a minute, he said, with some unwanted excitement in his voice. That thing over there, I wonder if that's a machine for speaking a record. Of course, I don't suppose that it will work after all these years, but we will try. Together, we moved over to the instrument which he had mentioned. We saw it was a form of box, and about halfway down, there was a line all the way around. Experimentally, we pushed up on the surface above the line, and to our delight, the box opened, and inside there were wheels and one thing which seemed to be for the conveyance of a metal strip from one spool to another. The lama, Mingyar donned up, peered down at the press buttons arrayed along the front. Suddenly, we nearly jumped out of our skins. We nearly turned and ran for it, because a voice came from out of the top part of the box. A strange voice, much, much different from ours. It sounded like some foreigner lecturing. But what was he lecturing about, we did not know. And then, surprise again, noises came out of the box. Music, I suppose they would call it, but to us it sounded all discords. So my guide pressed another button and the noise stopped. We were both rather exhausted with what we had discovered and by an excess of excitement, so we sat down on what were obviously chairs, and I felt panic because I seemed to sink right down in the chair as if it was actually sitting on air. As soon as we recovered from that shock, the lama, Mingyar Dondup, said, perhaps we should have some sampa to cheer us up, because I think both of us are quite exhausted. He looked about to see where we could light a little fire to warm up the sampa, and soon he was rewarded because there was a cubicle off the control room, and as he entered it, the light came on. The lama said, I think this must have been where they prepared their food, because all these buttons are not there for ornament. They're there for some useful purpose. He pointed to one button, which had a picture of a hand held in the stop position. Another button had a picture of a flame, so he pushed the one with flame marked on it, and above that instrument there were various metal vessels. We took one down. By this time we were feeling heat, and the lama moved a hand about and finally said, there you are, Lobsang, feel that. There is the heat for our cooking. I put my hand where he said, but a bit too close, and I jumped back in some alarm. But my guide just laughed and put near-frozen sampa in the metal container and then rested it on some bars over the hot thing underneath them. He added water, and soon we saw a little dribble of steam coming up from the dish. With that, he pressed the button marked with the hand symbol, and immediately the red glow ceased. He took the metal dish off the heat source, and with the metal thing with the big dished end, he ladled sampa into our bowls. For some time there was no sound other than the noise we made eating. With the sampa finished, I said, I wish I could get a good drink, I am as thirsty as can possibly be. By the side of the box, which made heat, we saw what seemed to be a big basin, and above there were two metal handles. I tried one and turned it in the only way it would go, and water, cold water, gushed out into the basin. I hastily turned the handle back and tried the other one, which was of a reddish color. I turned that, and really hot water came out, so much so that I scalded myself. Not very seriously, but I still scalded myself enough to make me jump. So I turned that handle back to its original position. "Master," I said, "if this is water, it must have been here one of those millions of years that you talked about. How is it that we're able to drink it? It should be all evaporated or gone sour by now, but I find it quite pleasant." The Lama replied, "Well, water can be kept good for years. How about the lakes and the rivers? They were water far beyond history, and I suppose this water is from an airtight container, which means that it should stay palatable. I surmise that this ship had just come here for supplies, and perhaps for some repairs, because with the pressure of water that came out, there must be quite a large amount in some storage tank. Anyway, we've got enough here to keep people busy for a month." I said, "Well, if the water kept fresh, there must be food here. Perhaps that is kept fresh as well." I got up from the chair with some difficulty, because it seemed to want to cling to me. But then I put my hands on the side of the chair, on the top of the armrests, and immediately I was not only released from the chair, but I was shot up to a standing position. Having recovered from that marvel and shock, I went along feeling the walls in the little kitchen. I saw a lot of indentations which seemed to have no purpose. I put my finger in one and pulled, and nothing happened. I tried to pull it sideways, but no, the thing didn't work. So I went to another one, and I pushed my finger straight into the indentation, and a panel slid aside. Inside that closet, or cabinet, or whatever the thing was called, there were a number of jars which seemed to be without any joins anywhere. There were transparent panels so that one could see what was inside. Obviously it was some sort of food, but how could food be preserved for a million years or more? I puzzled and puzzled over the problem. There were pictures of foods that I had never seen or heard of, and some of the things were encased in a transparent container, yet there seemed to be no way of opening the container. I went from one of these closets, cupboards, or storage rooms to another, and each time there was a fresh surprise. I knew what tea leaves were like, but here in one of the cabinets there were containers which I could see through the transparent sides containing tea leaves. There were other surprises, because some of these transparent containers had what was obviously cuts of meat inside them. I had never tasted meat, and I longed to have a go at it to see, or rather to taste, what it was like. I quickly tired of playing in the kitchen, and I went in search of the lama Mingyar Dondup. He had a book in his hand, and he was frowning and in a state of intense concentration. "Oh, master," I said, "I have found where they keep their food. They have it stored in boxes that one can see through, but there's no way of opening them." He looked at me blankly for a moment and then burst out with a laugh. Oh yes," he said. "The packaging of the present-day materials is nothing like the packaging of a million years ago. I have tasted dinosaur meat, and it was as fresh as if from a newly killed animal. I will come with you shortly, and we will investigate." I walked around that control room, and then I sat down to think things over. If these men were a million years old, why had they not crumbled into dust? It was clearly ridiculous to say that these men were a million years old when they were absolutely intact and appeared to be fully alive and just awaiting an awakening. I saw that there was a sort of small satchel that hung on the shoulders of each one, so I removed one from one of the sleeping bodies, and I opened it. Inside, there were curious bits of wire twisted in coils, and there were other things made of glass, and the whole thing made no sense at all to me. There was a rack inside full of buttons, press buttons, and I pressed one, the first one I saw. I screamed with fear. The body from which I had taken that satchel suddenly jerked and crumbled into fine, fine dust, the dust of a million years or more. The lama Mingyar Dondup came over to where I stood petrified with fright. He looked at the satchel and he looked at the pile of dust, and then he said, "There are quite a number of these caves. I have visited a few of them, and we have learned never to press a button until you know what it does, until you have worked it out by theory. These men knew that they were going to be buried alive in some tremendous earthquake, so the doctor of the ship would have gone to each man and put a survival kit on his shoulder. The men would then go into a state of suspended animation so that they would know nothing whatever of what was happening to them or around them. They would be as near dead as anyone could be without actually dying. They would be receiving adequate nourishment to keep the body functioning on a minute scale. But when you touch this button, which I see is a red button, you would have discontinued the supply of life force to the man in suspended animation. Having no longer a life force supply, his age would come upon him suddenly, and he would immediately turn into a pile of dust. We went around to the other men, and we decided that there was nothing we could do for them, because, after all, we were shut in the mountain, and the ship was shut in the mountain, and if these people came awake, would they be a danger to the world? Would they be a danger to the lamassaries? These men, of course, were possessed of knowledge which would make them appear as gods to us, and we were afraid of being made into slaves again, because we had a very strong racial memory that we had been slaves at some time. The Lama, Mingyar Dondop, and I sat together on the floor, not speaking, but each buried in his own thoughts. What would happen if we pressed this button? And what would happen if we pressed that button? And what sort of supply of energy could it be that would keep men alive and well, nourished for more than a million years? Involuntarily, we both shuddered at the same time. And then we looked at each other, and the Lama said, "You are a young man, Lobsang, and I am an old man. I have seen much, and I wonder what you would do in a case like this. These men are alive. There is no doubt about that. But if we bring them back to full life, what if they are savage? What if they kill us because we have let one of their number die? We have to think this over most seriously, and we can't read the inscriptions." He stopped there because I had jumped to my feet in some excitement. "Master, master," I cried, "I have found a book which seems to be a sort of dictionary of different languages. I wonder if it would help us." Without waiting for a reply, I jumped up and rushed into a room near the kitchen, and there was this book, looking as if it had just been produced. I grabbed it with two hands because it was heavy. And then I dashed back to the Lama, my guide, with it. The Lama took the book, and with ill-concealed, suppressed excitement, he opened the pages. For some time he sat there, absolutely absorbed in the book. At last he became aware that I was jumping about in extreme agitation, wondering what it was and why he did not tell me. "Lobsang, Lobsang, I'm sorry. I apologize to you," said the Lama. "But this book is the key to everything. And what a fascinating tale it is. I can read it. It is written in what seems to be our honorific language. The average person, of course, could not read honorific Tibetan, but I can, and this ship is about 2 million years old. It works on energy obtained from light, any light, the light of the stars, the light of the sun, and it picks up energy from those sources which have already used that energy and passed it on. These men," he referred again to the book, "were an evil lot. They were servants of the gardeners of the world. But it is the old tale. Men and women. Men want women just as women want men. But this ship was crewed by men who had abandoned the great mothership. And this, actually, is what they term a lifeboat. The food would be quite safe to eat, and the men could be awakened. But no matter how long they've been here, they are still renegades because they tried to find women who would be much too small for them, and their association with the women would be an absolute torture to the latter. They wonder if their life satchels will work or whether it will have been switched off automatically from which they refer to as the mother ship. I think we shall have to experiment a bit and read some more, because it seems clear to me that if these men are allowed to live, then they have such knowledge that they can do us harm, which we could never overcome, because these people treat us as cattle, as things on which to carry out genetic experiments. Already they have done harm because of their sexual experiments with our women, but you are too young to know all about that yet. I wandered around the place. The llama was lying down on the floor to ease his legs, which were giving him quite a bit of trouble. I wandered around, and eventually I came to a room which was all green. There was a very peculiar-looking table there, with a great big light over it, and there were what appeared to be glass boxes all over the place. I thought to myself, this must be where they repair their sick people. I'd better go and tell the boss about this. So I bustled off and told the llama Mingyar Dondup that I had found a very peculiar room, a room that was all green and which had strange things encased in what looked like glass but wasn't. Slowly he got to his feet and, with the help of the two staves, made his way to the room I had discovered. As soon as I entered, I was leading the way, lights came on, lights just like daylight, and the llama Mingyar Dondup stood there in the doorway with a look of immense satisfaction on his face. "Well done, Lobsang, well done," he said. "That is two discoveries which you've made. I am sure this information will be well received by His Holiness the Dalai Lama." He walked around looking at various things, picking up other things and peering at the contents of some of the, well, I do not know what to call them. Some of the things in glass cubes were absolutely beyond my comprehension. But at last he sat down on a low chair, and he became enthralled in a book which he had taken from a shelf. "How is it," I asked, "that you can understand a language which you say is at least a million years old?" With an effort, he put aside the book for a moment while he thought over my question, and then he said, "Well, it's quite a long tale, you know, Lobsang. It leads us back throughout the by-lanes of history. It leads us through paths which even some of the lamas cannot follow. But briefly, it's like this. This world was ready to be colonized, and so our masters, I must call them masters, because they were the head men of the gardeners of the earth and other worlds, dictated that a certain species should be grown on the earth, and that certain species was us. In a far distant planet, right out of this universe, preparations were made, and a special ship was made which could travel at an absolutely unbelievable speed, and we, as human embryos, were packed in the ship. Somehow, the gardeners, as they were called, brought them to this world. And then we do not know what happened between the time of the arrival of the embryos and the first creatures that could be called human. But during their absence from their home world, much occurred. The old ruler, or god, was aged, and there were certain people of evil intent who wanted his power, and they managed to get rid of that god and put another one, their own puppet, to rule in his place. His ruling, of course, to be dictated by these renegades. The ship came back from the earth and found things very different. They found that they were not welcome, and the new ruler wanted to kill them so that they would be out of the way. But instead, the gardeners who had just returned from the earth grabbed a few women of their own size, and they took off again for the Earth universe. There are many, many different universes, you know, love saying. Arrived at the world where they had been growing humans, they set up their own dominion. They built various artifacts like pyramids with which they could keep radio watch over anything coming in the direction of the earth. They used the humans that they had grown as slaves. They did all the work, and the gardeners just sat back in luxury and told the human slaves what to do. The men and women, perhaps we should call them the supermen and the superwomen, got tired of their own partners, and there were many liaisons which led to bickering and all manner of trouble. But then from outer space, and undetected by the pyramid searchers, a spaceship appeared. It was a vast ship, and it settled down so that people could come out of it and start to build habitations. The people who were the first on the earth resented the appearance of these other spacemen and women, and so from a battle of words there came a battle of people. The trouble went on for some time, and the most devilish inventions were made. At last, the people in the big spaceship could not put up with the trouble any longer, so they sent out a number of spaceships, which apparently were stored ready for such an occasion, and they dropped terrible bombs wherever these other space people were living. The bombs were a very advanced form of atom bomb, and within sight of where the bomb had exploded, everything became dead. There was a purple glare coming from the land, and the spacemen and women who had caused this got back in their giant spaceship and left the area. For 100 years or more, there was hardly any form of life on Earth in the bombed areas. But when the radiation's effects lessened, these people crept out in fear and trembling, wondering what they would see. They settled down to a form of farming, using wooden plows and things like that. "But Master," I said, "you say the world is more than 50 million years old. Well, there are such a lot of things I do not understand at all. For instance, these men, well, we don't know how old they are. We don't know how many days or weeks or centuries they have been here, and how can food have been kept fresh all these years? Why didn't the men crumble to dust?" The Lama laughed. "We are an illiterate people," Lob sang. "There used to be very much more clever people on this earth. There have been several civilizations, you know. For instance," he pointed to a book on the shelf, "this book tells about medical and surgical practices of a type we in Tibet have never even heard of, and we were one of the first people to be put on this earth." "Then why are we so high up? Why is our life so hard? Some of those picture books you brought back from Kathmandu show all sorts of things, but we have no knowledge of things like that. We have nothing on wheels in Tibet." "No, there is an old saying that when Tibet permits wheels to be brought into the country, then Tibet will be conquered by a very unfriendly race. Their predictions were just as if they could see into the future, and I am going to tell you, young man, that they could see into the future, and they had instruments here which will show you what happened in the past, what is happening now, and what will happen in the future," my guide said. "But how can these things last so long? If things are left, well, then they decay, they fall to pieces. They become useless through disuse, like the prayer wheel in that old lamasery that you showed me. A beautiful piece of work, corroded and immovable. How could these people stop things from decaying? How could they provide the power to keep things working? Look at the way the lights come on as soon as we enter a room. We have nothing like that. We use stinking butter candles or rushlights, and yet here we have light, which is as good as daylight, and it's not being generated anywhere, because in that book you showed me, there were pictures of machines that worked in a magnetic field and generated what you call electricity. We don't have that. Why is it that we are so isolated?" I was puzzled. The Lama was silent for a moment, and then he said, "Yes, you will have to know all these things. You are going to be the most educated Lama that there ever was in Tibet. You are going to see the past, the present, and the future. In this particular range of the mountains, there are a number of these caves, and at one time they were all joined together by tunnels. It was possible to move from one cave to another and have light and fresh air the whole time, no matter where we were. But this land of Tibet was once down by the sea. People lived on that land with just a very few low hills, and the people of that earlier age had sources of power quite unknown to us. But there came a terrific catastrophe because, beyond our land, scientists of a country called Atlantis let off a tremendous explosive, and that ruined this world." "Ruined this world?" I said. "But our land is all right. How is it ruined? How is the world ruined?" The Lama got up and went to a book. There were such a lot of books here. And he went to a book and found certain pictures, and then he said, "Look, this world once was covered with cloud. There was never a sight of the sun. We knew nothing about the stars, but then, in those days, people lived hundreds of years old, not like now, dying as soon as they've learned anything. People die off now because of the evil radiations from the sun, and because our protecting cloud cover had gone. Then dangerous rays came and saturated the world, bringing all sorts of diseases, all sorts of mental aberrations. The world was in turmoil. The world writhed under the impact of that tremendous explosion. Atlantis, which was a long way from here on the other side of the world, Atlantis sank beneath the ocean, but we, Tibet, well, our land went up 25 to 30,000 feet above sea level. People became less healthy, and for a long time people fell dead because there was not enough oxygen at this height for them. And because we were nearer the skies and where we were, the radiations were stronger. He stopped for a moment and rubbed his legs, which were paining him a great deal, and then he said, "There is a far part of our land which stayed at sea level, and the people there became more and more different from us. They became almost stupid in their mentality. They had no temples. They did not worship the gods, and even now they go about in skin boats, catching seals and fish and other forms of life. There are some immense creatures with enormous horns on their heads, and these people killed many of them and ate their flesh. When other races came along, they called these far northern people Eskimos. Our part of Tibet had the best people, priests and wise men, and doctors of great renown. And the part which was sheared away from Tibet and sank to sea level, or rather stayed at sea level, had the lesser mentalities, the ordinary workers, the ordinary people, the hewers of wood and the drawers of water. They have remained in almost the same state for more than a million years. They gradually crept out and set about making a living on the surface of the earth. They set up small farms, and within 100 years or so, things appeared to be normal and settled down. Before we go any further into our discussions, I will ask you to look at my legs. They are paining me a great deal, and I have a book here which shows wounds something like mine. I can read enough of it to be aware that I have an infection." I looked at him hard, because what could I, an ordinary chela, do for such a great man? But there it was. I took the rag wrappings off his legs and recoiled at what I saw. The legs were covered in pus, and the flesh looked very, very angry indeed. In addition, the legs below the knees were very swollen. The Lama said, "Now you will have to follow my instructions exactly. First of all, we have to get something which will disinfect these legs. Fortunately, everything here is in good condition, and up on that shelf you will find a jar with some writing on the glass. I think you will find it is the third container from the left on the second shelf down. Bring it over, and I will see if it is the right one. Obediently, I went over to the shelves and slid back a door which appeared to be made of glass. Now, I didn't know much about glass because we had very, very little of it in Tibet. Our windows were either covered with oiled paper to make them translucent and so admit some light to the rooms, but most people had no windows because they could not afford the cost of bringing glass all the way across the mountains, glass which had to be purchased in India. I slid the glass door aside, and then I looked at the bottles, and yes, this is the one, I thought, so I took it over to him. He looked at it and read some directions, and then he said, "You'd better pass me that big container standing there on the side upside down. Wash it out well first. There is unlimited water, remember, so wash it out, and then put a little water in it, about 3 bowlfuls of water." So I did that. I scoured the container thing, which was already spotless, and I guessed 3 bowls of water, and took it back to him. He, to my profound amazement, did something to the bottle and the top came off. I exclaimed, "Oh, you've broken the thing. Shall I try to find an empty one?" "Lobsang, Lobsang," said the lama, "you really do make me laugh. If there is something in this jar, then there has to be a means of getting it in and then getting it out. This is merely what you would call a stopper. I will use this stopper upside down, and then it becomes a measuring device. Do you see that?" I looked at the stopper, which he had upside down, and yes, I could see it was a measuring thing of some kind, because there were marks all the way down. So then he continued, "We shall have to have some cloth. Now, in that cupboard, if you open it, you'll find a lot of bundles. Open the cupboard door so that I can see." This door was not made of glass, and it was not made of wood. It seemed to be something between the two, but I pulled the door open, and then I saw that there were a lot of bundles in orderly array. The lama said, "Bring over that blue one, and to the right of it there is a white one. Bring that as well." He looked at me, looked at my hands, and said, "And go to the tap and wash your hands. By the tap you'll see a cake of white material. Wet your hands, and then wet that cake, and smear it all over your hands, being very careful to get your nails clean." I did all that, and I was quite interested in seeing how much lighter my skin appeared. It was something like seeing a Negro for the first time all black, and then seeing the palms of his hands, which were pink. Now my hands were just about pink, and I was just going to wipe them on my robe when the lama said, "Stop!" He pointed to something that he had taken out of the white package. "Wipe your hands on that, and don't you dare touch your filthy old robe after you've wiped your hands dry. You have to have clean hands for doing this job." It was really interesting, because he had a clean sheet of cloth stuff on the floor, and he had various things on it, a basin, a thing like a scoop, and another thing which I did not understand at all. It is so hard to describe, because I have never even seen such a thing, but it appeared to be a tube of glass with markings on it, and at one end there seemed to be a steel needle, while at the other end there was a knob. In the tube, which was obviously hollow, there was some colored liquid which bubbled and sparkled. The Lama said, "Now listen carefully to me. You will have to clean out the flesh all the way down to the bone. Now, here, we have the fruits of the wonderful, wonderful, very advanced science, and we're going to make full use of it. Take this stirrette and pull the end of the tube. Wait, I'll do it for you. And then you stick that needle in my leg just here." He indicated a particular spot. "And that will make the leg numb. Otherwise, I should probably faint from the excruciating pain which this is going to cause. Now go to it." I lifted the thing that he had called a stirrette, and I looked at the Lama, and I shuddered. "No, no, I can't do it. I'm so afraid of hurting you." "Love saying, you are going to be a medical Lama. Sometimes you'll have to hurt people to cure them. Now do as I say, and stick that needle in right up to the hilt. I will tell you if the pain is too much." I picked up the thing again, and I was afraid I was going to faint. But, well, orders were orders. I took hold of the thing not too far from where the needle joined the body, and I closed my eyes and I jabbed quickly. There was not a sound from the Lama. So I opened my eyes and found that he was smiling. "Lop Sang, you made a very fine job of that. I felt not a twinge. You're going to be a success as a medical Lama." I looked at him suspiciously, thinking that he was making fun of me. But I saw that, no, he was perfectly sincere in what he had said. He continued, "Now, we have given this long enough, and this leg feels quite dead, so it won't respond to pain. I want you to take those things. They're called forceps, by the way. I want you to put a little of this liquid in a bowl and then wipe the leg thoroughly in a downward direction. Downward, not up, but down. You can press fairly hard and you will find that the pus comes away in lumps. Well, when you've got a nice pile of pus on the ground, you'll have to help me move to a fresh spot." I picked up the things that he had called forceps and found that I could pick up a nice bundle of this white cotton stuff. I carefully dipped it in the bowl and wiped his legs. It was incredible. Absolutely incredible how the pus and the dried blood came pouring away from the leg, from the wounds. I got that leg quite clean. The bone was clean and the flesh was clean. Then the Lama said, "This is a powder. I want you to shake the powder into the wounds so it gets as far as the bone. It will disinfect the legs and prevent more pus from forming. When you have done that, you will have to bandage my legs with the bandage from that blue packet. So we went on, cleaning, 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 shaking in this white dust, and then putting some plastic wrapping thing over the leg, and after bandaging it, not too tightly, but just tight enough, by the time I had finished, I really was absolutely a sweat. But the llama was looking better. After I had done one leg, I did the other, and then the llama said, "You'd better give me a stimulant, love saying. It's up on that top shelf, and you just bring down one ampule. An ampule is a little container with a pointed end, and if you snap off the pointed end and jab the ampule against my flesh anywhere." So I did that, and then I cleaned up all the pus and the mess, and then I fell asleep on my feet. End of chapter 2.